to prevent a communist victory. He answered, "Cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail." If Johnson had granted General Westmoreland's request to enter Laos and block the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Hanoi could not have won the war. The entire approach to the war literally stood the principles of victory on their head. Moreover, by 1966, if the question of complete victory was in doubt, then it was right to again ask if Vietnam was the line in the sand for resisting communism wholeheartedly. A poorly conceived and inadequately undertaken military action only compounded the larger point. Why Vietnam? As the war dragged on, the only answer increasingly seemed to be, because we are there. In retrospect, a stronger response to either Berlin or Cuba may have proven more effective at stopping communism. When Ronald Reagan later referred to the great lesson the United States had learned in Vietnam, that we sent men to fight a war the government wouldn't let them win, he reiterated the central fact that military action must be both purposeful and pragmatic. If Vietnam was ever the former, a point that still remains in doubt, it was never the latter. In part, this end product stemmed from both Kennedy's and Johnson's reluctance to pursue the war in the first place. In part, it reflected the failure to grasp the fact that this was not, as critics later claimed, a civil war, but a thoroughgoing invasion of the South by the North. General Va A Bom of the North Vietnamese Army let slip that in 1959 he had been instructed to lead the liberation of the South. But the failures also illustrated the radical left's complete dominance of the dialogue involving the war. Those sent to fight had virtually no voice at home. A few photographs of Vietnamese villagers who had been disemboweled or had their heads impaled on posts by the communists would have destroyed all the leftist arguments and demonstrations from the beginning. Johnson, rejecting the advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, JCS, not to engage in a limited bombing of the North or to use any sort of gradual escalation, chose to do just that. Like Kennedy, he hoped at first to get by with mere U.S. support of the ARVN. In July 1964, Johnson had boosted U.S. strength there to 21,000 men, up 30% from Kennedy's levels. Then in August, an incident occurred that sealed the involvement of the United States in Vietnam. On August 2nd, the U.S. destroyer Maddox, operating in the Gulf of Tonkin off North Vietnam, reported that it was under attack from North Vietnamese PT boats. Questions later arose as to whether the Maddox had been attacked at all, although the North Vietnamese confirmed the attack. 2 days later, a second attack supposedly occurred on the Maddox and a second destroyer, the Turner Joy. And this time, the ships called for air support. Commander James Stockdale, one of the first aviators on the scene, performed a thorough reconnaissance and concluded in his official report that there were no North Vietnamese vessels in the area and that the Maddox and Turner Joy had probably fired on each other in the haze. Johnson went on television to announce that he had ordered air responses to the attacks. At the same time, he sent a resolution to Congress, which he wanted adopted retroactively, that was the functional equivalent of a formal declaration of war. The August 17th Gulf of Tonkin resolution said, "Congress approves and supports the determination of the President to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression." Johnson received all the support he needed. Only two senators, both Democrats, voted against the measure. Voting in favor were soon-to-be anti-war activists George McGovern, Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota, and William Fulbright of Arkansas, all Democrats. Bobby Kennedy, still LBJ's Attorney General, but future senator from New York, supported the 1964 war wholeheartedly. Johnson, although vastly underestimating the undertaking to which he had committed the nation, did not lack an awareness of the implications of fighting a war on the Asian mainland, saying, "We're not going north to drop bombs at this stage. I want to think about the consequences of getting American boys into a war with 700 million Chinese." But the Viet Cong would not cooperate in letting the United States play a peripheral role. On Christmas Eve, 1964, Viet Cong bombed a Saigon hotel that quartered American junior officers, killing 2 and wounding 38. Then on February 7, 1965, a mortar attack on the American airbase at Pleiku resulted in more casualties. Hundreds of aircraft moved in, but Johnson refused to order a bombing campaign. The Viet Cong had already achieved a victory of sorts. More soldiers were needed to keep the aircraft safe, and as the security area around the bases was expanded, the ground troops needed more air power to keep them safe. It was a non-strategy, a quicksand, with no hope of producing a victorious outcome. Finally, in March 1965, more attacks led Johnson to approve a bombing campaign known as Rolling Thunder. And as the name implies, Johnson did not intend for this to be a knockout blow or an overwhelming use of power to intimidate the enemy into surrender, but an incremental, gradualist strategy. He denied outright the military's request to strike oil storage facilities. Quite the contrary, McNamara and Johnson picked the targets themselves, placing sharp restrictions on what was fair game, claiming the purpose of the operation was to present a credible threat of future destruction, emphasis ours. In essence, McNamara had staged a giant demonstration with live anti-aircraft fire directed at U.S. airmen. It was immoral and wasteful, and it was guaranteed to produce a more determined enemy while at the same time doing nothing to limit the North's ability to fight. North Vietnam responded by erecting 31 acquisition radars, adding 70 MiG fighters, and installing deadly SA-2 surface-to-air missiles, SAMs. By 1967, Hanoi possessed some 7,000 to 10,000 aircraft guns and 200 SAM sites, and could claim credit for downing 80 U.S. aircraft. Even then, American aircraft fighting over the North were instructed that they were not authorized to attack North Vietnamese air bases from which attacking aircraft may be operating. Nor did Johnson and McNamara permit American pilots to eliminate the SAM sites. The rules of engagement throughout Rolling Thunder stipulated that American aircraft could only attack SAM sites that were actually firing at them, emphasis added. Limited war of this sort had been addressed by no less an expert than William Tecumseh Sherman 100 years earlier. "War is cruelty," he said, "and you cannot refine it." Air historian Mark Klodfelter in 1989 published a scathing critique of the Vietnam bombing campaign, noting that the objectives of Operation Rolling Thunder had been to give us a better bargaining counter, our emphasis, rather than defeat or cripple the North. By necessity, this approach involved the President and the Secretary of Defense in target selection and the timing of missions. Soon, the bombing policies became a morass, with administration officials, but not the military, battling over whether a highway with no moving traffic could be a target, and even debating the definition of a convoy. Meanwhile, from 1956 to 1963 alone, before the United States was heavily involved, China had poured 270,000 guns, 200 million bullets, and 10,000 pieces of artillery into North Vietnam, not counting the 327,000 troops sent to the North to work on construction projects, freeing up North Vietnamese troops to head south. Put another way, the Chinese nearly matched the entire contribution of American forces at its peak, meaning that the United States fought four enemies in Vietnam: the Viet Cong, the North Vietnamese, the Russians, and the Chinese. On the ground, the United States had grown disenchanted with ARVN operations. By late 1965, U.S. troop numbers, including all personnel, naval, air, and other, had reached 200,000, a number well below what the JCS had categorically stated more than a year earlier would be needed to win. Based on the balance of forces alone, the war should have ended long before 1965. One of the problems involved the complete lack of strategy. General William Westmoreland, named the new Army commander in Vietnam in March 1964, was impatient with the South Vietnamese operations against the Viet Cong and had introduced search and destroy missions by American forces. Whereas U.S. artillery, air, and armor, to the extent it could be used, had previously supported the ARVNs, the new strategy called on the ARVN units to guard cities and strongholds, exactly what the South Vietnamese warlords wanted in order to preserve their troops from combat. Worse, it placed American troops in a position to absorb the bulk of the casualties. Aimed at finding the communists in the countryside, eliminating them and their supply bases, and gradually expanding the safe area of operations, the search and destroy missions, as with all McNamara ideas, depended heavily on numbers and tallying, specifically of body counts. How many Viet Cong did an operation kill? The calculation turned into a giant con game. Forces in the field well knew that the VC tended to drag bodies off so as not to let their enemy know the casualty numbers, and that tactic consequently led to estimates. Before long, the estimates were wildly inflated, and grotesquely, the policy rewarded the production of any body, whether a genuine VC or not. Loyal or neutral Vietnamese caught in firefights were added to the body count totals. The policy had no grounding in common sense whatsoever. No democracy would willingly fight a long war of attrition. It goes against the grain of democratic republics to measure success purely in numbers killed, especially when the enemy, in this case, made clear that it welcomed such a trade-off in human carnage. Ho Chi Minh had explained this exchange flatly to the French in the 1940s, saying, "You can kill 10 of my men for every one I kill of yours, but even at those odds, you will lose and I will win." Ho's statement reflected an awareness that the communists had no qualms about sacrificing one-third to one-half of their population to gain a strategic victory. Human life had little meaning to those running the war in Hanoi. McNamara took his technical solutions to an absurd level when he proposed building a giant electrified reinforced fence across the north-south border to stop the flow of supplies. Quick fixes, technology substituted for a sound warfighting doctrine, was what Clark Clifford, McNamara's replacement as Secretary of Defense, found when he arrived on the job in 1968. "It was startling," Clifford said, "to find out we have no military plan to end the war." By that time, U.S. troop strength neared 470,000, and casualties mounted. One massive problem that Johnson tried to ignore was that the Allied forces, including over 60,000 Australian, Korean, Philippine, and New Zealand soldiers, were not just fighting Viet Cong rebels in black pajamas, but also a large and well-equipped People's Army of Vietnam, PAVN or PAVN, or North Vietnam's Army. These troops received their supplies from no less than the Soviet Union itself, and they delivered them to the south along the infamous Ho Chi Minh Trail, a more than 350-mile pathway through the jungles of Laos, which terminated at strike points opposite Da Nang Air Base and the Plaikoo and Ang Khi fire bases. For all these substantial and, in most cases, debilitating weaknesses, the United States still had to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. The watershed event came with the so-called Tet Offensive on January 31, 1968, when the Viet Cong assaulted multiple targets throughout the South. VC troops even reached the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, where they, contrary to popular movie renditions, were killed to a man. They stormed the old capital of Hue and surrounded the U.S. base at Khe Sanh. They made spectacular gains, but at great cost. For every American soldier or Marine killed at Khe Sanh, 50 North Vietnamese died, a ratio approaching the horrendous slaughter between the Spaniards and Aztecs in Mexico or British and Zulus in southern Africa. At Hue, the surprised and outnumbered U.S. Marines evicted 10,000 Viet Cong and Vietnamese regulars from a fortified city in less than 3 weeks and at a loss of only 150 dead. From that point on, any pretense that Vietnam was a civil war was over, except, of course, in the national media. The only hope the communists had to win had to come from direct and heavy infusions of troops and supplies from Hanoi, Moscow, and Peking. At Khe Sanh, nearly 25,000 air sorties subjected the seasoned North Vietnamese attackers to a merciless bombardment, killing 10,000 communists compared to 205 Americans. One senior American general called Khe Sanh the first major ground battle won almost entirely by air power. A U.S. military historian, Robert Leckie, referred to Tet as the most appalling defeat in the history of the war for Hanoi, an unmitigated military disaster. Even General Tran Van Tra, a top-ranking communist, agreed. We suffered large sacrifices and losses with regard to manpower and material, especially cadres at the various echelons, which clearly weakened us. Yet the very failure of the communists' Tet Offensive illustrated the flawed nature of U.S. strategy. Here, in a single battle, Americans had achieved a 50-to-1 kill ratio, and yet the media reported this as a communist victory. Embassy in Saigon captured, read one erroneous headline. Television repeatedly showed a photograph of South Vietnamese police chief Nguyen Nhoc Lan shooting a man in the head, claiming the man was a Viet Cong suspect. In fact, the man was a Viet Cong colonel in civilian clothes, a man Lan knew personally, and by the rules of war, a spy. Andrew Jackson had done almost exactly the same thing to British agents more than 120 years earlier, but Jackson did not have to deal with the power of television or the impact of the camera. Scenes were cut and spliced in the studios into 30-second clips of Marines and body bags with an accompanying text, American troops mauled. After Tet, the most trusted man in America, CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite, told his viewers the war was unwinnable, at which point Johnson reportedly said that if he had lost Walter Cronkite, he'd lost the American people. Even Newsweek, hardly an objective, patriotic source, admitted that for the first time in history, the American press was more friendly to its country's enemies than to the United States. Ironically, the polls showed Johnson consistently drew higher support when he turned up the pressure and when he restarted the bombing of the North. Before the 1968 election, polls showed that no more than 20% supported withdrawal, and some of that 20% represented hawks who preferred escalation to retreat. Virtually every aspect of the war and military service associated with it was miscast and then etched into bad history. 2/3 of the troops who fought in Vietnam were volunteers, not draftees. Blacks in Vietnam only comprised about 12% of the troops, equivalent to their percentage of the population as a whole, and college graduates were more likely to be killed or wounded than non-college grads, a reasonable conclusion considering all the pilots and almost all officers were college graduates. Far from fighting alone, the United States was joined by Korea, the Philippines, Thailand, Australia, and New Zealand. The Taiwanese would have joined the war if Johnson had let them. But because of Hollywood and the press, Vietnam is usually portrayed as a poor man's fight conducted mostly by draftees. Coming apart. No American war has ever enjoyed the full and unwavering support of the entire U.S. population. Federalists threatened secession in 1812 in protest of Mr. Madison's war. Henry David Thoreau was jailed over his opposition to the Mexican War, a conflict that even Lincoln challenged. And the Civil War produced protests against the draft that required the use of Gatling guns to disperse rioters. World War II came as close as any war to unanimous support, and even then there were dissenters. Vietnam differed sharply because without a declaration of war, the administration lost a tremendous psychological patriotic edge. People debated a policy decision as opposed to an act of national security. Moreover, inept handling of the press and failure to propagandize the conflict in the manner that a life and death struggle demands only invited rebellion and criticism at home. In short, Vietnam, in almost every respect, was a textbook example on how not to conduct a war. The media's proclivities toward an open society increasingly demanded that Americans consider the communists' point of view and questioned whether U.S. leadership had an interest in the outcome. This, in turn, meant that acts of defiance against the government were magnified, exaggerated, and highlighted. Real dissent certainly existed. Selective service, better known as the draft, had been reinstituted during the Korean War and had been renewed regularly by Congress. But a host of exemptions, including those for marriage and education, allowed all married men plus upper and upper middle class men to elude induction. Resistance built and protest appeared. A March for Peace took place in Washington in late 1965, and a month earlier the first publicized case of a draft card burning had occurred. Pollsters swept into action, measuring support for the war. Unfortunately, polling, by the nature of its yes or no answers to questions, tends to put people into one of two camps, eliminating options. Consequently, depending on the wording of a particular poll, one could prove that the majority of Americans either approved of or disapproved of the Johnson administration's handling of the war at any given time. One segment of the population, which grew steadily but which peaked at about one-third, was referred to as doves. The doves themselves were split. One group criticized the Vietnam War primarily on moral grounds, namely that the United States, as a capitalist imperial power, represented the embodiment of evil in the world, whereas communist states, no matter what their excesses, nevertheless were forces for progress toward a utopian society. Most of those in this echelon of the dove wing consisted of die-hard communists, dropouts, social outcasts, militant anti-American revolutionaries, or disaffected youths who, whatever their education, were ignorant of the most basic elements of foreign policy. Another dove wing, the liberal Democrats, generally embraced John Kennedy's original vision of paying any price, bearing any burden to advance democracy. But they nonetheless saw Vietnam as the wrong war in the wrong place. To this pragmatic wing, the general strategy remained sound, but Southeast Asia already looked like a quagmire the liberals wanted to avoid, because it also threatened to suck funds from Great Society social programs. Many journalists, such as David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan, fell into this category. The opposite segment of public opinion, labeled the Hawks, represented the conservative anti-communists in the Republican and Democratic parties. Hawks viewed it as a critical signal to the Soviets to hold the line in Vietnam as a continuation of containment that had proved moderately successful in Korea, Iran, and, its greatest success, NATO and Western Europe. For the Hawks, withdrawal was not an option because it would put into play the domino theory and topple the other states in Southeast Asia, threatening the entire southern fence holding in the Soviet Empire. Among the hawk wing of the Democratic Party, the labor unions provided consistent support for the war. After Nixon's election, the so-called hard hats, who represented construction and line workers, frequently clashed with the student radicals and the hippies at protest marches. Three streams converge. Vietnam was unique in rallying a large core of opponents, perhaps ultimately as large a share as the Tory population opposed to Washington's armies in the American Revolution. What made the Vietnam protests somewhat different was three forces that combined in the mid-1960s to produce the student mass demonstrations that disrupted American college campuses and ultimately spilled over into the cities. The first stream to flow into the radicalism of the decade occurred when the baby boomers knocked on the doors of the universities. Boomers numbered some 79 million people born between 1943 and 1960. Coming of college age by 1959 at the earliest, they ushered in a tidal wave of students into American universities, tripling the percentage of bachelor's degrees awarded to 23-year-olds between 1950 and 1970. The student population, already 2.5% in America, further expanded. This demographic quake alone would have sent shockwaves through the system, despite the fact that two-thirds of the boomers never went to college. Something else relating to education was at work, however, namely the deprivatization of education in the United States. In the 1960s, the percentage of students attending public rather than private institutions rose from 59% to 73%. And the image of a college graduate as an elite member of society disappeared when millions of veterans took advantage of the GI Bill. Public universities reflected this transfer from private to public, especially in California, which opened three new campuses in 1964 and 1965. By their very size, whatever age bracket boomers have occupied has been the cultural and spiritual focal point for American society as a whole. More bluntly, it was always about them, and most of the cultural and spiritual trends were troubling. The boomer generation's death rates from suicide, drunk driving, illegitimate births, and crime set records, relatively and absolutely. The incidence of serious crime rose twice as fast for the boomer generation as for the population as a whole. Meanwhile, families in which boomers were raised, as well as their own marriages, fell apart with growing frequency, with the ratio of divorces to marriages going from 1 in 6 in 1940 to 1 in 3 by 1970. It is from this background of abundance, self-centeredness, and permissiveness, combined with instability and lack of direction, that the boomer students arrived on university campuses in the early to mid-1960s. Because of lower standards, American university enrollment rose from 3.6 million students in 1960 to 9.4 million by 1975, when baby boom enrollments began to flag. Schools such as the universities of Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona State, and Ohio State University all saw their campuses explode to contain more than 40,000 students each. The University of Michigan's football stadium alone could hold 102,000, larger than the entire population of Bologna, Italy. More than 1,000 new colleges or universities, not counting hundreds of community colleges and technical and trade schools, opened during the expansion. In 1950, the United States had 1,859 public and private institutions of higher education, a number that had risen to 3,055 by 1975. These trends were not confined to the United States. Germany saw its student population rise fourfold from 1950 to 1970, and three Italian universities alone had more students than existed in all of Italy just two decades earlier. Most of these American institutions were public universities, 1,454 in 1975, reflecting the national sense that a college education was desirable and that a means to guarantee a college education needed to come from tax dollars. As a precursor to these attitudes, several studies purported to show that from 1947 to 1958, the knowledge industry had accounted for more than 28% of the nation's income, growing twice as fast as the GNP. Other scholars argued that it had increased the nation's wealth by more than half, and Clark Kerr likened the university's transforming effect on the economy to that of the railroads. By the end of the 1960s, nearly half of all young men were going to college, while at the same time a striking grade inflation had started, which was more pronounced for the boomer generation than any other in history. The average collegiate grade rose from C+ to B between 1969 and 1971, overlapping a historical SAT slide of at least 24 points for some schools and up to 50 points for others. Never was getting a good grade so easy for so many people, yet never had it represented so little. Some of the incentive for obtaining a higher education came from the oft-cited income statistics showing there existed a direct correlation between years of schooling and salary. In 1949, when the boomers' parents began to contemplate the future, the after-tax lifetime income for a person completing 16 years of school was almost double that of a person with an eighth-grade education, a precursor to the late 20th century when real wages for those with less than a high school diploma fell compared to college graduates, whose income rose at a strong rate. Between 1956 and 1972, the lifetime income of men with college educations had increased to almost twice that of male high school graduates. In the process of appreciating the genuine benefits of education, however, Americans deified the college degree, endowing it with magical powers of transformation that it never possessed. This nearly religious faith in education spending accounted for a second major factor that helped foster student riots in the 1960s. Money, especially federal dollars. It began in 1958 when the National Defense Education Act not only expanded the federal education budget, but also marked the key shift by making Uncle Sam the financial dynamic of education. During the Great Society, Washington earmarked still more money for education, particularly for less affluent students. The flood of money was, as usual, well-intended. Congress had originally sought to buttress math, science, and engineering programs at colleges and universities. In fact, the money merely filtered through the math and science programs in true academic egalitarian fashion on its way to liberal arts and social science programs. This development by itself might not have produced such a disaster in other eras. In the 1960s, however, a third element combined with the explosion in student numbers and the rising tide of funding, namely the leftward tilt of the faculty on campus. The academy always tended toward liberalism, but liberal inclinations were kept in check by religion, government, and society to render a relative degree of political balance for more than a century. In the 1930s, the artistic and intellectual elites rejected capitalism, many going so far as to endorse Stalinism. One study at Bennington College from 1935 to 1939 showed that students' attitudes swayed dramatically as they matriculated through the university. Some 62% entered Bennington as Republicans, but by the time they graduated, only 15% still considered themselves Republicans. On the other hand, the number of those who considered themselves socialist or communist tripled during the same period. With the end of McCarthyism, many universities found that not only could they not discriminate against communists, but they no longer had any right to question radical scholarship either. After all, the thinking went, who's to say what's right or wrong? Such views did not go far in science, business, or engineering, but the requirements at most universities in general education fields meant that the extremely activist and liberal faculty elements were concentrated into required classes in history, English, philosophy, and social sciences. In other words, where they would reach the most students. At the same time, students were inadequately grounded in the basic principles of capitalism or communism. By the end of 1962, the New York Times noted a discernible national trend against teaching about communism in schools. The anti-McCarthy reaction at the university level led to a dramatic shift in the other direction. Conservatives were ostracized, viewed as no longer cutting edge. Tenure committees increasingly had more Marxists on them, and those leftist scholars wielded the tenure knives as freely as the McCarthyites had on communists. In part, this, too, represented a generational revolt against established existing faculty in colleges by young professors seeking to flex their muscles against groups, including many World War II vets, that they thought had given inordinate support to McCarthy's movement. Consequently, just when students cognitively reached an age where they could understand the deeper issues of capitalism and communism, they arrived at universities ill-prepared to challenge the increasingly radical university faculty they were likely to encounter in required classes. Yet it would be inaccurate to portray the student protest movement as directed by the professors. Although faculty advisors may have provided ammunition for the cause, it was radical students who led the attack. Many of the agitators' leaders were red diaper babies whose parents were Communist Party members or socialists. Some were not even students at the time, such as Tom Hayden of the University of Michigan, a journalist who worked as a field secretary for the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. Hayden, later known for his famous marriage to actress Jane Fonda, co-founded the Students for a Democratic Society in 1960 with Al Haber, a local Michigan radical. Haber received support from the socialist Student League for Industrial Democracy. Though publicly anti-Soviet, they had no intention of opposing communism in word or in principle. Steeped in Marxism, both Haber and Hayden hated American capitalism and the middle-class society it produced. The committed Hayden, praised as the next Lenin, organized a meeting of activists in Port Huron, Michigan, in 1962 that produced the manifesto of the movement called the Port Huron Statement. The Port Huron Statement enjoined students to seize control of the educational system from the administrators and government, that is, from the taxpayers. Hoping to distance themselves from the Stalinist atrocities of the 1930s, the SDS and other radical organizations called themselves the New Left. One of the key tenets of the Port Huron philosophy was that the United States was the source of conflict and injustice in the world. Equally important, though, was the notion that students were ideally suited to lead, and that the university was the ideal location, if not the only one, from which to launch the new radicalism. Consequently, at the very time that waves of new baby boomer students were swarming into institutions of higher learning, they were greeted with a torrent of money and a liberal, if not radical, faculty that challenged traditional norms of patriotism, religion, and family. Reinforcing the message of the student radicals, the faculty provided social and intellectual cover for the disruptions that soon occurred, justifying the mayhem as necessary for education and social reform. Under such circumstances, the surprise was not that violent campus revolutions ensued, but that they took so long, especially in light of the Vietnam War, which provided a focal point for anti-American hostility and revolutionary rhetoric. Red Diaper Babies. At least some of the unrest emanated from Moscow, which trained and supported an extensive network of radical leaders for the purposes of disrupting American society and alienating youth from bourgeois ideas. Sit-in protests and mass demonstrations at California campuses appeared as early as 1958, usually directed at a specific incident or university policies. After 1964, however, at the University of California at Berkeley, the demonstrations grew increasingly violent under the free speech movement. According to the history of the American Communist movement, communists and other varieties of Marxists and Marxist-Leninists were among the organizers and leaders of the free speech movement. SDS leaders, such as Carl Davidson, David Horowitz, Country Joe McDonald, and other red diaper babies, proudly proclaimed their Marxist-Leninist sympathies. Bernadine Dorn, leader of the SDS in 1968, asked if she was a socialist, answered, "I consider myself a revolutionary communist." Although some in the peace movement discouraged a communist presence, the left did not need to be taken over in the conventional sense. A takeover from below had occurred in the form of an infiltration by many thoroughgoing communists and fellow travelers. In an absurd scene of supreme irony, suburban radicals such as Tom Bell of Cornell faced harassment and taunting from the audience at the 1968 SDS convention when members of the Progressive Labor Wing howled curses at him for being too anti-communist. Here was a revolutionary who wanted to destroy, or at the very least, fundamentally eviscerate the foundations of American democracy and capitalism, being called a red baiter. Consequently, just as the SDS had established itself on 350 to 400 campuses across the country, claiming perhaps 100,000 members, communist elements within the organization tore it apart, achieving the goal of the more militant communists of pushing the radical movement toward street violence, yielding its position of influence to the militant weathermen. Campus violence was never a case of emotions getting out of hand, as is sometimes portrayed. Nor was it a case of frustrated student radicals who lacked the patience and discipline for nonviolent protest. Rather, it represented a predictable evolution of events when a radical minority steeped in revolutionary tactics and filled with an ideology of terror attempted to impose its worldview on the majority by shutting down facilities. But as early as 1964, spontaneous protests for student rights were revealed to be organized, deliberate disruptions designed to choke off all educational activities. It is important to establish clearly, in their own words, the goals and objectives of the radicals, and to note that traditional means of social control, especially arrest and imprisonment for purposes of rehabilitation, had little meaning to people who viewed arrest as a status symbol. Jerry Rubin, one of the leaders of the New Left Yippie movement, expressed his contempt for the system within which most of the activists operated. Violating the law had no negative connotation for the Yippies, and few feared genuine reprisals from the repressive establishment they denigrated daily. destroying property, insulting police and city officials, polluting and breaking the law in any way possible were jokes to some. To others, arrest only signified their commitment or validated their ideology. Reuben, called into court, laughed. Those who got subpoenas became heroes. Those who didn't had subpoenas envy. It was almost sexual. Whose is bigger? I want one too. The adrenaline rush of activism completely distorted reality. Susan Stern, a member of the violent Weathermen gang that blew up a University of Wisconsin lab, killing a student, had participated in the Chicago riots. Charged with aggravated assault and battery and assault with a deadly weapon for attacking police, which carried a maximum penalty of 40 years in prison, she recalled being enthralled by the adventure and excitement of my first bust, oblivious to the prospect that she might spend most of her life behind bars. Bill Ayers, a future compatriot of Barack Obama, was also a weatherman who planted a bomb at Chicago's Haymarket Memorial statue. Ayers later told the New York Times, "I don't regret setting bombs. I feel we didn't do enough." Radicals like Reuben noted that the essence of the movement was twofold: repel and alienate mainstream American society, setting the radicals up as anti-establishment heroes who would have a natural appeal to teens and college students seeking to break away from their parents, and refuse rational negotiation in order to polarize and radicalize campuses, and, they hoped, the rest of the United States. Reuben repelled and alienated quite well. As he once put it, "We were dirty, smelly, grimy, foul, loud, dope-crazed, hell-bent, and leather-jacketed." The hippies took pride in the fact that they were a public display of filth and shabbiness, living in the flesh rejects of middle-class standards who pissed and shit and fucked in public. Far from hiding their drug use, Reuben noted, "We were constantly stoned and tripping on every drug known to man and were outlaw forces of America displaying ourselves flagrantly on the world stage." For mainstream America, which often received skewed news reports of the ostensible causes of the disruption, it appeared that students only wanted to challenge unreasonable dress codes, or have a say in curriculum, or protest unpopular college policies. These causes for protest masked their true tactics, which were to use any initial demand as a starting point for closing the university, then destroying the rest of society. As radical leaders themselves later admitted, they practiced a strategy of constantly escalating demands so that no compromise could ever be reached with them. Reuben, who drafted many of these early tactics, explained, "Satisfy our demands and we go 12 more. All we want from these meetings are demands that the establishment can never satisfy. Demonstrators are never reasonable." Emphasis ours. When the demands reached the point that no rational university administrator or public official could possibly comply with them, Reuben noted, "Then we scream, righteously angry. Goals are irrelevant. The tactics, the actions, are critical." Yet Reuben was not being entirely candid. Short-term goals were irrelevant, but the destabilization of society as a long-term objective was quite relevant to the activists. Saul Alinsky's 1971 Rules for Radicals provided a guide map to destroying the system and, in the process, anyone who got in the way. Over time, the movement not only grew more radical, but also more blatantly anti-American. Peter Collier, on the staff of Ramparts magazine, recalled, "We had a weekly ritual of sitting in front of the television set and cheering as Walter Cronkite announced the ever-rising body count on CBS. Actress Jane Fonda visited Hanoi in 1972 with her then-husband, activist Tom Hayden. In a famous photo, she posed sitting in the gunner's seat of a North Vietnamese anti-aircraft gun, exactly the type used to shoot down the American pilots who were held nearby in the Hanoi Hilton prison, being tortured and starved, then spoke on Radio Hanoi as American POWs were forced to listen. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Enhancing the freedom from responsibility and the associated notion that normal activities such as holding jobs and raising families were somehow meaningless, the new drug culture spread through the underculture like wildfire. Timothy Leary's famous call to tune in, turn on, and drop out reached innocent ears like a siren song, and many youth, already convinced their parents had lied to them about rock and roll, sex, and Vietnam, listened attentively. LSD, lysergic acid diethylamide, was the subject of extensive tests by the CIA in the 1950s. One CIA researcher recalled the lab staff using it themselves, saying, "There was an extensive amount of self-experimentation because we felt that a first-hand knowledge of the subjective effects of these drugs was important." LSD spread throughout the subculture, and by the 1960s, dropping acid was equated with a religious experience by beat poet Allen Ginsberg. Increasingly, intellectuals in the 1960s advocated chemical use purely for pleasure and mind expansion. And not just LSD, but mescaline, heroin, amphetamines, Ditran, and other mysterious substances, all, of course, undergirded by the all-purpose and ubiquitous marijuana. Writer Ken Kesey credited his LSD trip for his insight in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Leaders of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement saw drugs as a natural element in their attack on conformity. And indeed, drug use was, in their view, an important political catalyst that enabled questioning of the official mythology of the governing class. Or, as a veteran of the free speech movement bragged, "When a young person took his first puff of psychoactive smoke, he became a youth criminal against the state." It was all so much empty rhetoric, but when draped in the language of academia, it took on a certain respectability. Sexual freedom without consequence was glamorized and pushed by Hollywood and the music industry. Censorship laws, which had eroded since the U.S. Supreme Court's Roth decision, 1957, established that obscenity had to appeal to prurient interests and run contrary to contemporary community standards. Justice William Brennan further eliminated barriers to imposing any limits by ruling that the public could not ban a work unless it was utterly without redeeming social value. This, of course, meant that no town ever could prohibit any book or movie, since someone could always find redeeming social value somewhere in the work. The free love movement, supported by the hippies, also reinforced the attack on constraints. Three strains of free love arguments appeared. One held that any breaking of sexual taboos and any attack on censorship represented an advance against the male-dominated power structure. Thus, some supported the women's movement not because it allowed women to seek self-fulfillment outside the home, but because it undercut capitalism and traditionalism. A second, more radical wave of sexual politics involved the quest for polymorphous perversity, a call to try everything, do everything, and ignore all restraints. This was most characterized by a growing promiscuity, couples living together or shacking up, which introduced new venereal diseases like herpes simplex and later AIDS. A few communalists even experimented with polygamy, and this kind of cultural relativism could unintentionally encourage more perverse forms of sexual experimentation, including pedophilia. A third group, Homosexuals, originally not associated in public with the free love movement, challenged the institution of heterosexual marriage generally outside of the language used by the hippies. While their most flamboyant members usually took center stage, there had always been a number of closeted homosexuals across America who lived as couples and served in the military. Homosexuality started to become mainstream after the Stonewall riots in New York City. Police had routinely raided homosexual bars, but during the June 1969 raid on the Stonewall Inn, patrons did not disperse as usual, and a crowd gathered. A scuffle between police and bystanders soon spun out of control, with local Greenwich Village residents joining in. After the papers covered the riots, more protests and disturbances followed, and homosexuals soon organized in the Gay Liberation Front, having adopted the term gay to describe and mainstream their lifestyle. Within 2 years, homosexual rights organizations had been formed in every major city in the country, and their protests at the American Psychiatric Association, which had viewed homosexual behavior as deviance, forced that organization to remove same-sex encounters from its diagnostic and statistical manual. No doubt some Americans held the radicals' views about marriage, sexual liberation, and homosexuality in all previous eras, but the physiology of conception placed severe constraints on, if it feels good, do it. Pregnancy out of wedlock was received with such social ostracism that it curtailed experimentation, even if social mores seemingly punished females more than the often unnamed male partners. The pill changed that to the extent that the 1999 millennial issue of The Economist called it the greatest scientific and technological advance of the 20th century. Without question, the pill also triggered a boom in women's education similar to what men had experienced. In medicine, first-year women students tripled within 10 years of the spread of the pill, and female MBA students nearly quadrupled. Whatever its beneficial effects, the pill exacerbated the erotic impulses already spinning out of control. Rock music reaffirmed the sexual and drug revolutions at every turn. By 1970, although still exceptionally popular, neither the Beatles nor their bad boy counterparts, the Rolling Stones, had the aura of hipness, despite the fact that both bands had recorded albums that were heavily drug-influenced. They found themselves eclipsed by new and more radical groups whose music carried even deeper drug overtones. Jimi Hendrix sang of flying on giant dragonflies, and Jim Morrison of The Doors saw himself as the Lizard King. Pink Floyd, Jefferson Airplane, and Iron Butterfly unashamedly wrote music for drug trips. By this time, even clothing embodied anti-establishment traits. Blue jeans, the anti-fashion, completely dominated the youth culture, constituting what one author called the jeaning of America. The entire genre emphasized sex and free love, pointing to the Woodstock Music Festival of August 15th through 17th, 1969, as evidence of what a hippie republic would look like. Peace, love, and rock and roll, read the logos on commercial products celebrating the event. Gonna join in a rock and roll band and set my soul free, wailed Stephen Stills of Crosby, Stills & Nash, CSN, in the anthem of the three-day concert. CSN popularized the event with a top 40 song called Woodstock, and the group starred in a full-length movie that followed. Woodstock was touted as a new stage in the psychic evolution of the world, a mass celebration of what the 1960s was all about, an assertion defying reality. when up to 500,000 hippies, the counterculture rock fans, including more than a few chronic drug users, showed up at Max Yazger's farm to hear a cornucopia of headline rock bands, the result was predictable. It had little to do with love or peace, and quite a bit to do with money. As one participant recalled, there was a lot made of how peaceful the event was, but what else would 500,000 kids on grass, acid, and hog tranquilizers be? Woodstock, if anything, was the point at which psychedelic drugs ceased being tools for experience and became a means of crowd control. Said Grateful Dead guitarist and drug addict Jerry Garcia, "You could feel the presence of the invisible time travelers from the future." But Garcia apparently didn't see the kids freaking out from megadoses of acid or almost audibly buzzing from battery acid crank like flies trapped in a soda can. Having celebrated drug use within a few years, Sly Stone, David Crosby, Keith Moon, Janis Joplin, and Jimi Hendrix, among other participants at Woodstock, either died of overdoses or otherwise suffered severe health problems. Other Woodstock veterans met similar distasteful ends. Felix Pappalardi of Mountain survived one drug overdose, only to be shot by his wife in 1983. Hendrix, already a guitar legend, wrapped up Woodstock with a truly apocalyptic vision of a battlefield with zombies crawling over a field littered with paper cups, plastic wrappers, and half-eaten food, gnawing on corn husks, slobbering over ketchup and mustard-smeared half-eaten hot dog rolls sprinkled with ants. The event generated the single largest pile of garbage of any event in human history, and when the perpetrators departed, they left the mess for someone else to clean up. What was undeniable, however, was the fact that rock music came entirely from the people and that government had absolutely nothing to do with it. Its very presence posed a challenge to those who insisted on the necessity for a National Endowment of Arts or National Endowment of the Humanities. Here was a new, raucous, and refreshing music form that had risen up entirely without a dime of government support, indeed often with the opprobrium of local and state governments. Moreover, rock music and its cousins, blues, gospel, country, and jazz, embodied the essence of American freedom in its very structure, beginning as a group, ending as a group, but always inserting somewhere in the middle the epitome of individuality, the guitar or keyboard solo. It was this element of rock, not its lyrics or glitzy lifestyle, that attracted those behind the Iron Curtain to Western ideas and soon helped erode the communist state's control over them. Less than a week before Woodstock, on August 9, 1969, the cult followers of Charles Manson broke into the house of director Roman Polanski in Bel Air, California. Polanski was away, but his beautiful pregnant wife, Sharon Tate, and four of her friends were home. Manson's gang, though not Manson himself, stabbed and butchered the house guests, smearing slogans on the walls in the victims' blood. Reflecting the depravity of the counterculture, the underground paper Tuesday's Child named Manson its Man of the Year. Yippie leader Jerry Rubin said he fell in love with Manson's cherub face and sparkling eyes, and Bernadine Dorn, leader of the Weathermen, exclaimed, "Dig it! First they killed those pigs, then they ate dinner in the same room with them, then they even shoved a fork into Sharon Tate's stomach. Wild!" If anything, the Manson murders hurled icy water on the 60s myth that drugs made people holy, nonviolent, or pure. At any rate, the drug culture and the so-called hippie movement never represented the majority view in America. It certainly did not outnumber the body of apathetic or apolitical youth, and even though it enjoyed better publicity, the hippie movement may have had fewer adherents than a growing conservative student movement that had taken root 2 years before the Port Huron statement. The media did not view conservative youth groups, such as the Young Americans for Freedom, as newsworthy, and thus they never received the attention or coverage of the radicals, but they were influential nonetheless. Traditionalists and conservatives, those that Richard Nixon would call the silent majority, all faded into relative non-existence from the media's perspective. It was much more interesting to cover a firebombing or a riot. Protests, mobs, and the media. Given the radicals' dominance of the anti-war movement, it should not be surprising that the demonstrations at the time of the Democratic Convention in August 1968 and the moratorium events of October 1969 were orchestrated by organizations with changing names but with essentially the same cast of leaders. On March 31, 1968, Lyndon Johnson shocked the country with an unexpected announcement that he would not again seek the Democratic nomination for president. Polls had indicated that he probably would lose, especially with a challenge from the dovish side of the Democratic Party. Equally shocking to some was that one of the emerging doves, Robert Kennedy, had abruptly repudiated his brother's war. Suddenly, many who still yearned for the presidency of John Kennedy and the magic of Camelot found him available again in the person of Robert. But just 2 months after Martin Luther King's assassination, Bobby Kennedy, giving a speech in Los Angeles, was killed by Sirhan Sirhan. The motive given for the assassination, Sirhan was an Arab nationalist, remains puzzling to this day. Kennedy did not have a reputation as a strong friend of Israel, although he did come from New York, which had a strong Jewish lobby. Kennedy's assassination left a void among the anti-war left in the Democratic Party, whose dove leadership now devolved to the rather bland Eugene McCarthy. Certainly, though, the anti-war left would not unite behind Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey of Minnesota. A tireless legislator and principal author of the affirmative action laws, Humphrey lacked the commanding presence of a national leader and could only have won by sidestepping the turmoil that the anti-war elements promised to bring to the Democrats' convention. Those groups sought to nominate McCarthy, a sincere-looking, soft-spoken senator from Minnesota who reminded people of a wise uncle. His appearance enhanced his anti-war positions, which were in many respects dangerous. Between 10,000 and 20,000 protesters moved into Chicago, and Democratic Mayor Richard Daley, having just regained control of the city from race riots, had no intention of allowing a new group to disrupt the Windy City. He authorized police to shoot to kill any suspected looters. Daley placed the nearly 12,000-strong Chicago police on 12-hour shifts, augmented by 7,500 Army troops airlifted in from Texas, Oklahoma, and Colorado. He dispatched police to guard Chicago's water supply and assembled Daley dozers, jeeps specifically outfitted with rolls of barbed wire on the front to clear streets of demonstrators. More important, he had already infiltrated the radical groups, sabotaging their schemes to acquire buses and giving out false information at phone banks. After weeks of denying the protesters' march permits, Daley relented. The first riot broke out on August 25, 1968, when the police charged Lincoln Park, driving the peaceniks out. One policeman told a reporter, "The word is out to get newsmen." And Daley himself implied that journalists would not be protected. A symbiotic relationship which developed between the Chicago protesters and the news media accelerated, But the journalists also failed to see the adroit manipulation by the demonstrators. Witnesses reported an absence of violence until the mob sought television cameras, at which point they began their act. A later study by the National Commission on the Causes and Prevention of Violence reported that demonstrators stepped up their activities when reporters or photographers appeared, and worse, camera crews on at least two occasions did stage violence and fake injuries. Emphasis ours. The city of Chicago issued a report on the riots, charging that the news media was guilty of surprising naivete. But in reality, the television cameras especially had encouraged and facilitated the rioters, and the images shifted all the blame to the police, who had their share of malignant club-wielding patrolmen. Advocates for maintaining public order were few and far between. NBC Today Show host Hugh Downs asked his viewers if the label pigs didn't apply to the Chicago police. Chet Huntley of NBC complained that the news profession is now under assault by the Chicago police. And Walter Cronkite said on the air that the Battle of Michigan Avenue made him want to pack my bags and get out of this city. Such rhetoric quickly faded as the media quietly reaffirmed its support of the Democratic Party in the general election. The 1968 race pitted the inevitable nominee, Humphrey, against the suddenly revived Richard Nixon, who had made one of the most amazing political comebacks of all time to capture the Republican nomination. Just 6 years earlier, when he lost the governor's race in California, Nixon had told reporters, "You won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore." Nixon resurrected himself largely because of the rampant lawlessness in the country and his insight that Americans longed for law and order. He also understood that, if elected, he had to get the United States out of the war one way or another, and he therefore claimed to have a secret plan to get America out of Vietnam. His anti-communist record suggested that whatever it was, it would not be concession to Hanoi. Claiming there was a silent majority of Americans who did not protest and did not demonstrate, but worked at their jobs, paid their taxes, and raised their families, Nixon appealed to the many who held the country together, kept the roads and Social Security funded, and raised kids who never broke any laws, yet who constantly found themselves portrayed by the media as boring, unimaginative, unhip, uncool, and generally not with it. In selecting Spiro T. Agnew, the governor of Maryland, as his running mate, Nixon further alienated the media and the elites, handing them a human lightning rod to absorb their attacks. During the first incarnation of the Republican Southern strategy, Nixon told Southern Convention delegates that he would not ram anything down your throats, and that he disliked federal intervention. Many took Nixon's comments as code words for a lackadaisical approach to desegregation, which they may well have been, but he had also acknowledged that states did have legitimate constitutional protections against federal interference. At any rate,